Okay, Michael, why don't you tell everyone who you are?
Okay, we're both here, my wife and I. Her name's Super Pankine, and usually called Super, or a nickname B. And I'm Michael Kine, the husband. Us meeting was kind of odd and sounds very odd when you start to hear it. I was originally born in a place called Downham in Kent in England at the end of World War II, 1944. I spent the first 6 months of my life in what was called an air raid shelter, but what it was basically a hole dug in our backyard with a corrugated iron roof, with all the dirt from inside the hole on top of the roof. And we had some wooden bunks either side. That was for me, the baby, my sisters, Moonin and Maureen. They was born 10 years before me and 8 years before me. And my brother Patrick, who was 4 years older than me. Also, Granddad was in the shelter with us. And my mother, at that time, she was around about 22 or so. There was a wooden pallet on the floor of this hole where she slept, and she had to sleep on the pallet because the hole was always full of water because there was no drainage because, as I say, it was literally a hole in the ground. We survived that, oddly. That was
1944
when we was in that hole. And we was also part of the evacuation of London when the British government decided to move all children out of London and into the countryside, literally to save the next generation, because there was so much bombing going on. I won't go into the evacuation because that's a whole nother life. And that would take too long. But the government did literally move millions and millions and millions of children out of the London area within a two-week period. And we was part of that. And during the war, we came back and forth to London, as my dad, who was in the army at the time, when he would hear how terrible the conditions were, would move us back to London.
But he was Irish.
Yeah, my dad left Ireland because he was as they called in those days, a bastard child. So being Catholic and having technically no parents, his life was pretty grim at that time. So he came to England, I think, when he was about 19 or so. And then with a few years, he was inducted in the British Army and put in one of the worst places to be in the war, which is in London, in the Pioneer Corps, where he put out fires, got bodies out, and also much later after he passed away, we found out he was also a bomb disposal guy. Anyway, after the war, our entire family, all the men in the military, civilians, everybody, distant cousins, you name it, every single one of us survived unharmed from the war, which was a miracle because where we lived on the edge of London, it was being bombed all the time. Our proper life started, I guess, when we moved out of our home in the suburbs of London, which basically we lived in a sort of brick tent. There was no running water. We had a pump in the kitchen. We had no electricity. There was a gas light. There was no bath. We had a metal bathtub. So my dad, somehow, he was in the construction jobs, and he somehow got us a list on a new estate built on outside of London in the countryside, which was amazing to us. I mean, we went from seven people being crammed in two rooms, and when my granddad passed away, there were six of us. And we had three bedrooms.
And granddad was a cobbler.
Yeah, my granddad was a cooper, which is person made barrels, and that job obviously faded out. But also there was many other stories. Our family is kind of a story-making family. Anyway, we're now ensconced in the new house, and we were surrounded with 400-year-old woods of oak trees. We're surrounded by farms, apples, plums, pears, you name it. And so basically my life as a child began then, because prior to that I had no friends or anything.
But you have to pay for your gas and water.
Yeah, when we had baths in the new house, instead of having to pump water out of a pump in the kitchen, we actually had running water. But to heat the water, we had some meter that we had to put coins in order to get enough hot water. We had a lot of childhood memories. One of the questions I was looking at before we came in here was I ever in trouble? And I was pretty well in trouble all the time. We weren't evil, but one of our most famous tricks we pulled off when we was kids, there was a thing called knockdown ginger, where basically you would go up to someone's door, usually in the evening, knock on it, run away and hide while someone opens the door, and then you just kept doing that until they drove you crazy and chased you. So we decided to up the game once, because this was getting a bit old and we was getting a bit in danger, let's say, of a good butt kicking from some annoyed neighbor. So what we did, all the houses, because it was government designed, were all directly opposite each other all the way up the road. There was about 80 houses. So there were very few cars in those days. In our street, there was, I think, two or maybe even one. But what me and my friend did was got some thread, and we went to the top of the road, tied the door knocker, because we had little door knockers then, walked across the street, pulled the string tight, tied it to the opposite door knocker, and did that the entire street. So there's 40 houses on either side of the street, all with the knockers tied to either one. So then we sat and waited, and eventually the sort of one other car in the neighborhood come down the street. And of course, it went down the street, he broke the strings, and the knockers would bang, and all the people would open their doors. So first it was two people, then four, then six, then eight, because it only took a few seconds for the car to go down the road, breaking all these strings. And then we ended up with 40 door lights on, 40 doors open, and 80 odd people looking across the street at each other, wondering what had happened, that every single door in the street was open. So that was one of our escapades. But to jump forward, I have jumped forward many years to how my wife and I met, which was her mother and my sister were great friends, because my sister and her husband had gone to Thailand and met over there, because my wife's from Thailand and her mum was a representative of Royal Dutch Airlines. So her and my sister become great friends. And my wife's mother used to stay at our house when she was in London. Well, eventually, Super was... she'd been sent to various places in the world to, like an exchange student, and she was about, she'd just come from, was it France you just came from?
I went to high school in Arcadia, California, and then when I graduated, before starting college, they made me go to, my mom sent me to France, because I love France. So I went to France, and afterward, she said, "Why don't you go and visit Michael and his mom?" So we did. I did. I went to London and visit Michael.
Yeah, but she's missing out the very first meeting when she was sent to England to stay with my aunt. And this sounds a bit weird, really, because she was only 12 years old, and that's when I actually first met her. Of course, I was 20. And I had my own girlfriends and that, and she was just on the periphery of my life, because I was running around doing crazy stuff, and she was staying with my aunt. Then the next time was after she came again for a visit.
I was 18.
No, you was 15 when you came.
I came again after high school.
But she was 15 years old, and oddly at that time, she arrived at the airport, and the fashion then was the girls wore transparent shirts with no bra underneath, so that was a bit of a interesting meet when she was about 15. And then eventually I ended up, after various adventures in the United States, and that's by this time she
because
was 19.
Because I was here.
Yeah, she was already here, and I came over, and she was dating some Chinese guy. And
I was going to Pasadena City College.
Yeah, so how we actually started going out was he couldn't dance, and so for some reason he would take me along, because I guess I was sort of more brotherly situation then, because we actually hadn't started dating yet. And so it was weird. We go out as a threesome. He would pick up the tab, and I would dance with Super, and then as I was staying with her and her mum at the time, he would drive off, and I'd go home with the girl. So that just led to us dating.
And my mom, here, her infinite wisdom, put us together in the same bedroom.
Yes.
Because figuring that he's like a brother to me more than another guy.
Yeah, so that clearly didn't work out too well. And so we was dating for a while, and then a friend of mine that I met in another period of my life called up and asked if I'd ever gone sailing. And at this time he was
in
California.
And he was living in Malibu.
Yeah,
that was Frank.
Yeah, his name is Frank. He lived in Malibu. And his grandma died and left him a bunch of money, and he'd always liked sailing because we used to go sailing together on a catamaran. And so I said, sure, I'd like to go sailing. And a few weeks later, he was in England. He called me up. He said he got a boat. It was built in 1908, a fantastic-looking boat, 40 feet long. And I said, sure. So the only way I could get out of the country is I gave Super what I thought was a sort of engagement ring. And
but I didn't know. He never asked me that he wanted to marry me. Apparently, he asked my mother, and she never shared.
Yeah, I actually, from the boat, I wrote a letter asking her mum, and I guess her mum decided I was a bit of a reprobate. So I guess all this is leading up how to we got married, because there was lots of other twists and turns in our life. So anyway, I go to England, and we learn how to handle this big, heavy sailing boat. As I say, it's 40 feet long, weighed 15 tons. And we met some guys that had gone to
say, what city?
Oh, well, we was in Lymington. Yes, Lymington. The boat was anchored in Lymington. And, of course, we had to do a lot of retrofit, because my friend, and I guess me too, had this idea of sailing around the world in this boat and sort of making a book of it.
And they wanted to be the first to reach the Suez Canal when they open.
Yeah, we wanted to be the first boat through the Suez Canal. With us at that time was my friend's girlfriend, who sadly has passed away. Her name was Gail. And anyway, we learned how to sail, and met lots of interesting people. We met Mr. Kevin O'Riordan, who, when he was 21 years old, was the chief of police of all India, and literally would get brigands, as he would call them, and hang them. We met motorbike racing champions, all kind of people. It was a wonderful period in England. And finally, we got the boat ready and set sail. Now, bear in mind, this was the first time we'd ever gone any attempt at, you know, going out of sight of land with the sailboat, of course.
No, I wasn't with them, and they were crossing the Bay of Biscay for their first sails.
Yeah, so the Bay of Biscay is some of the roughest water on the planet Earth, because the ocean goes from, you know, thousands of fathoms to a few hundred. So you have to basically sail kind of away from the Bay of Biscay on one angle and then come back on another angle and arrive in Spain. So, because if you get in the bay, there's no way you can get out because the waves just keep pushing you in. So you have to go on this kind of pyramid trip to get across the Bay of Biscay. Well, we just had started out, and we weren't, I think it was about a day into the trip or so, when a storm came in. And there's me, my friend, and this young girl, Gail, I think she was about 19 at the time. We were going up, the registered waves at that time were over 45 feet high. We was literally surfing across, and we spent 8 days basically of going across these horrendous seas and with little experience. So initially we had way too much sails up and all kinds of mayhem was going. So eventually sometimes we were sailing at full speed, the boat would go, which was 12 knots, just with the mast and a tiny sail on the front because the winds were so powerful. Anyway, eventually we arrived in Corona, Spain, and the seas had calmed a bit, and we come sailing in, and a boat came out and anchored us, and there's all these people on the shore. There's dance band, there's flags, there's gorgeous women in low-cut gowns and all this, and this ragged-ass group comes staggering off the boat, and we're thinking, wow, this is one hell of a party town. And then they asked us, you know, what the name of our ship was, and we told them. And apparently at the exact time we left England, the tall ship race to Spain had begun, and they thought we was part of the race to go to Corona, which of course we weren't. So immediately they took us off the fancy anchorage they had for us and tied us next to an old
barge. Out into the ocean.
Anyway, we kept on sailing. You know, there's once again many, many stories. And eventually we end up in Malta, which is just near South Italy. And Super decided to fly out from the United States.
On top of that, I have to quit work. And then my mom gave me a ticket to go to Malta. And I went and stayed at this hotel waiting for his boat to arrive. And I got I was fortunate enough to run into a bunch of British sailor, and they were in the 80s. They were there for their submarine reunion, which is the submarine that helped the Maltese during the World War. And that was the most interesting because they want me to go inside the submarine and see it. And I went in there, and it was just totally amazing. And then Michael arrived. Now, mind you, just so you know, Michael does not swim at all. So he's on a sailboat, just arrived and came and meet me. And it started from there.
Yeah, basically, when we sailed in, we started telling people what was happening. In fact, was Super was here. So one of the wealthy yacht owners next to us arranged for a taxi, and the taxi come in, and I climbed in the back and laid on the floor because we hadn't been on customs yet, and the taxi smuggled me out to go to where Super was staying. So anyway, she joined the boat, and we was getting once again ready because with sailboats, particularly, you know, those kind, for every day sailing, it seems you spent a week fixing whatever was broken. So we decided to set sail to try and go through the Suez, and off we went. And
our first aim was to go to Greece.
Actually, we was aiming to go to Suez direct, but like always, as soon as we left Malta, we ran into another giant storm. Well, this one was so rough that the two girls just got hopelessly seasick. So we literally had to put them in their bunks, and we had these canvas things that you hook to the top of the boat so they wouldn't fall out of the things, and they was just sick as dogs. And the only thing they could eat was canned peaches because they said it tasted better when they threw them up again.
Well, mind you, just so you know, it's a 40-foot Burmese teak boat with four people in it. Gail was 18 and I was in my 20s, and Michael and Frank. So Michael and Frank is taking care of the boat, and me and Gail was just totally out of it. And Frank is a vegetarian, so he's serving the first meal after the storm was avocado with omelet. So you can imagine when you've been seasick all this time, and that's the first thing you see. That's why I said, give me the can of peach.
So anyway, we're going through this storm. I mean, this was a serious storm. The waves weren't big like the Bay of Biscay, but the winds were literally, there was almost hurricane strength. There was like, going across the Bay of Biscay, the winds were anything up to force 11. Force 12, I think, is basically almost a hurricane. So anyway, we're getting beaten to death out there. At one point, it was hailing, and we had hail all over the boat. And ice. This is in the Mediterranean. I mean, it sounds crazy. Well, eventually, we decided there was no way we was going to make it to the Suez Canal, so we headed towards Greece. We readjusted our course. Incidentally, both Frank and I got really expert at navigation. Now, bear in mind, at that time, 45-odd years ago, we didn't have any fancy stuff. We just had a sextant. We didn't even have a two-way radio.
We don't even have refrigerator.
Yeah, we canned all our food. We didn't have a refrigerator. We didn't have any radio contact with the rest of the world. We was pretty basic. But one good thing was a friend of ours, Tony, that we met in Malta, was a radio ham at that time. So he called a friend of his in Crete, which is where we was heading.
No, our friend in Malta was Lyle Greeno. His wife was Thai, so we got to meet. And Lyle is a ham radio. And he ham radio Tony in Crete and said, look for a boat called Joya, that's what our boat name. And look for four people, and there's a Thai girl in there. So Tony Edler and his wife, Annette, come and meet us at the port and looking for this boat that looked rumble up, and that's us.
Well, basically, it looked a bit like a pirate ship because it was a black hull and burgundy sails. But the big thing was we come into Crete. I mean, the boat was, anything that wasn't bolted down was gone because of this storm we'd gone through. So we anchored. And me and Frank lifted the girls. They was literally couldn't even climb the ladders. They were so sick. So we hoisted them onto the dock, laid them out like a couple of corpses. And me and Frank sat on the edge of the dock, passing a bottle of whiskey back and forth. And about this time, Super lifts her head off the concrete. And she says, I'm never getting on that fucking boat again. So basically that was the end of my
relationship with the boat.
Yeah, so we did see the boat sail off with Frank and Gail, which they had another voyage. And if anyone's interested, Frank wrote a book about the whole trip. So anyway, we're now in Greece. And Sue had a ticket from her mom to go to Thailand.
Because my mom is in Thailand, so she said, come home, leave the boat. And so I did. I jumped on the plane and left.
So that was leaving me on the dock. And no money. My clothes were in Athens because at that time there was a Greek
coup
where the military took over the government. And so when I had what little money I had in the United States wired to me, it didn't just come straight through, because what the army was doing and the Greek government was any money that was wired into Greece, they'd hang on to it for a while. So they had like these gigantic amounts of money, free loans. Fortunately, Tony Edler and his wife at that time put me up, because I would wear the clothes during the day. I'd come back to their apartment. They would wash my clothes, and I'd wear them again the next day. So eventually my money did come through, and off I went to Thailand, where Super and I got married, and then come back to the United States and started a life of mortgages, children, and all the rest of it. Now, one of the questions was about our careers. Well, we had two completely different careers. Mine originally started, oddly enough, when I was about, I was in fact 10 years old, and I was fascinated with printing. So at 10, I saved up and bought myself a printer machine, and would print business cards and letterheads and this kind of stuff. So Super at this time, because I was only 10, was only, of course, where she was born.
In Singapore, where my parent met. And then my father left and go to Thailand. According to him, he was on a business trip. And then my mom, being young and 19-year-old, and thought, okay, he's a good man. Turned out that he actually go back to Thailand to his first wife, so, and second wife. And being that's natural.
Yeah, so, and that was, by the way, that's first, second, third wife, and they was all at the same time. These weren't one after the other.
And then the third wife being my mom. And so she decided that, you know, she wanted to be with him in Thailand. And I was 6 months, and when she brought me to Thailand, and that's where I was basically raised until I was 16 and come to United States.
So so Super went in a different route to me. So she got into the airline business. Her mom started a travel agent.
But before that, I was in a clothing business, which I dearly love. I started work on Lake Street in Pasadena with a little tiny boutique called Papagayo. And I was the window decorating and salesperson. And then I decided that I wanted to do something bigger and better. So I went to work with Bonwood Teller in Beverly Hills. And again, I was a salesperson there. And then Michael left to go on the sea. And that's where it's gone.
And she, of course, had some various contacts with some very famous actors and actresses. And it's amazing how bad some of those people behaved. She had contact with actresses that would take a whole pile of dresses to say they wanted to try them on. The dresses would come back all covered in drink and food splashes, and they'd just leave
them
there.
And we saw the picture of them wearing it at the Academy Award.
Yes, so anyway, my first contact with printing, I then went to school, and I was just the worst student. Once again, I had a lot of adventures there, until finally at 16 years old, I'd had enough of this torture. I mean, in a class of 40, I was 32. I mean, the people below me probably needed to be in mental institution. I was just awful. So I was walking with my mum, and we went past a sign company, a very famous one at the time, Pierce Signs. And they had a sign up asking for a trainee draftsman. So my mum says, "Oh, that's a lovely job, son. Why don't you go and try that?" So in I go, and, I went in, got some application, and then I come back wearing a fancy suit and all this kind of stuff. Well, a fancy suit, my only suit. And had the interview, and apparently I impressed the guy. And because oddly enough, the only thing I had passed in school was technical drawing, so that helped. But then came the dreaded question. At that time, when you got a new job, they'd ask to see your school reports. So I took mine in. There was about 4 years, I think, in this particular book. And there's a lot of humming and hawing. And
being Cockney, you have to prove yourself.
Yeah, because I had a very, very strong Cockney accent. So basically, I mean, if you want to know prejudice, it takes different forms. Because of my strong Cockney accent, that eliminated me from any public job, you know, banks, insurance, any of this stuff, just because of my accent.
And having a dad who's Irish, yeah, which is lower than low.
Yeah, my dad, when he first come to England, I mean, it sounds astonishing now, but on the boarding houses, it would say, no blacks, gypsies, or Irish. So that was my dad's status. So we come from pretty poor beginnings, let's say. So anyway, I took my report in, and the guy's doing a lot of ums and ahs and a bunch of chuckles, and he said, is there any reason you can tell me why I should hire you? And I said, well, I tell you what, give me 2 weeks. If at that time you want me, you can pay me and hire me, but if not, you don't have to pay me and kick me to the curb. So that's how I got that job. And then I moved on to silk screen printing, and I think that's when Super started in the airline business around that time. And no, that was much later, wasn't it? Because I was only 16.
I started the airline business when I was married to you, and we were here in 1975, 76, and we bought our first condo in Huntington Beach because my mom moved to Huntington Beach. And so we bought a condo, and we thought, oh, my God, this is a cat whistle, and loved it. And have our tortoise live on the balcony. We have 3 tortoises and a big, giant cat. He's 26 pounds. We name him Floyd. And Floyd live on the flower box, sleep and eat in a flower box, and come in the house once in a while. And then after that, I decided to get a better job, and I put in an application for Air Cal, and Air California, and then got hired there, and went to work for them, and it been merged to American and U.S. Air, and now I've been working for 35 years and retired with it.
When I was in this sign company, I was doing very well, but I got a bit bored. So I saw this advertisement. I was 19 at the time, about a company wanting someone to take charge of their silkscreen printing department for 400 stores, doing all their posters and displays and all this kind of thing. Well, oddly enough, at Pierce Signs, one day they took on a job, and it was silk screen printed was needed. And one of the guys there said he knew about it. I'd never seen it before. So they had a little hand screen and a squeegee. Most probably everyone knows T-shirt printing. It's kind of that, but you can print posters and everything. So we're printing this little sign with a little squeegee, and I'm watching this. And I thought that looked pretty good. So I went and applied for this job, to take charge of printing for 400 stores. So I went for the interview, and, you know, they asked me all the questions, can you do this, can you do that? Well, I couldn't do anything, so of course I told them I could do everything. So it was a few weeks later I got a telephone call saying, hey, Mike, you've got the job, but you're only 19, and could you get someone older to come and sort of be the pretend boss? So I said, okay. I got a friend of mine, Bert, to sign up. He was getting a bit bored too. So we're on the train station on the way to our first job, and we're sitting there waiting for the train, and Bert said, by the way, Mike, you do know all about screen printing, don't you? I said, well, in all honesty, no, all I saw was someone doing a little hand screen thing. That's all that's the experience I got. So, of course, he's going, Jesus Christ. So, anyway, I go to the newsstand, And there's all the newspapers, and right in the middle of it was the silkscreen printer's guide. I mean, I've never seen one in the newsstand before since. They only had the one copy. I bought it and read it on the train. So when I finally got to the business, they had an entire print shop set up, and with automatic machines and everything. So I'm eyeballing this. I'm telling Bert what to do, how to make the stencils and everything. Anyway, long story short, the first job ever turned out absolutely perfect, and that's how my silkscreen printing career started. And then, of course, you know, as I say, there was lots of other adventures. We finally got here to the United States.
So when, anyway, just wanted to bring back to Orange County. I did work for Air California in Newport Beach, and that's the first airline Newport Beach have had. Mr. Clifford, who is the president of the company, and it's an amazing little airline, and we worked like a family, and it was great. At this time, Michael is working at Watts.
Oh, yeah. The
for somewhere in L.A.
It's a silkscreen printing company in Watts. I used a similar technique to get in there. They had this giant camera, and they asked me if I'd ever...
And the company is called Burrell?
No. Well, the main one I went to is Murray Scoff Enterprises. But
there we go.
I become their cameraman. I had no idea this camera was 20 feet long. I'd never seen one in my life before, but I said, sure, I can do that. So on the first night I was there, I allowed myself to be... they shut the company up, and I just hid in the dark room. And I literally worked all night and figured out by the following morning how this camera worked. And work that I did then is still being used today on all the Disney posters and all that kind of stuff. I made the original stencils and artwork for that. And there was a little note in the questions asking us what our happiest day was. For me, my happiest day when our little daughter was born.
Firstborn
daughter. We'd been married for 10 years at that time. And the unhappiest day for me happened to occur on Thanksgiving. And I mentally figured out that my daughter, my son, we'd had another baby, and my wife all had a life-threatening disease, for want of a better word, called Marfan syndrome. And, you know, since then, because of this Marfan syndrome, all three of them have had heart surgery.
Open heart surgery.
My daughter's was an emergency situation. My wife has had two open heart surgeries. And I remember when I put two and two together on Thanksgiving, we had a lot of people there, and as they was leaving, I just started crying my eyes out because I thought I was going to lose them all. So now my wife is 65, survived two heart surgeries, a stroke, a few brain hemorrhages.
67 and, to be exact.
Well, she's the accurate one. I'm a generalization sort of person. So
basically, that's our story in Orange County.
Yeah.
We bought our second home was in Westminster, and now we moved to Lake Forest. And that was amazing. We'd never think we could ever afford that because I always been in the circuit of minimum wage, no matter where I go. So Michael is okay. We're always doing everything 50-50. I take care of the security part, which is like health insurance and everything. And Michael would take care of the money to live on. So it was worked pretty good for the last 35 years.
Actually, it's 45 years altogether.
Well, we've been married for 44 now.
So,
can you believe?
Yeah, so the... it has been teamwork, and I would say ours has not been the smoothest life, but all the hardships we've been through has made this a pretty solid relationship. And
when we first came to Lake Forest, it used to be dirt road and a lot of orange tree and eucalyptus. What happened?
Yeah, we're not sure. And also, of course, when we had our house, Super's parents moved in, when we had the two children, that made six of us, and living in this house. So,
and two dogs, and eight cockatiel,
and five tortoises. So, we didn't all have our rooms, but the house is big enough for all the at least vertical walking
34
people.
34 square feet.
Yeah, 3,400 square feet. So right
we're
now,
very fortunate.
We was very lucky. A lot of hard work. So, you know, none of this come easy to us because neither one of us had extensive training in any particular thing. But it all came from hard work and taking risks. I mean, we did a few things, agreed to a few things that were not exactly easy, but we made it through. And always we know that if everything goes down the toilet, we'll figure out how to do it. We've always figured it out. And
we will survive.
Yes, we will. And sometimes education, isn't it, as cracked up as it is made out to be. So we've made it pretty well without a hell of a lot of education.
We got two kids, one son-in-law, one daughter-in-law, and a grandbaby. And she's a punch.
Yeah, she's. I think she's. I think they got a similar kid to what I was growing up with, because you never know exactly what this little girl's going to do. So I think that's a wrap. We've got a few minutes left, and as I say, I think what we can say to anybody out there, if you want to do something, go ahead and do it. So that's about it, I think. Okay.
Are you sure you are finished recording? Yes.